Adoraita Gadad Harshi Vasadi Gaur Bhakti Mukhija Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gogopina Shyama Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Kija Vrindavan Dham Kija Mathura Dham Kija Abhidri Mayapur Dham Kija Jagannath Puri Dham Kija Gangamai Jamuna Devi Kija Bhakti Devi Kija Tulsi Maharani Kija Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Kija Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale. Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nivasesis Nivadi Paskachade Satarane. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vikam Sam Sajiva Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Anchakapatu Vishcha Kipasandavya Bhachapatitanam Pavaniva Vaishnavamscha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So it's December 12th, 2015, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 52, Rukmini's. Rukmini's message to Lord Krishna. Let's go this way. Oh, I see. So first we're just going to read over this summary. This chapter describes how Lord Balaram and Lord Krishna, running as if in fear, went to Dwarka. Then Lord Krishna heard the message of Rukmini from the mouth of a Brahmana and chose her as his wife. King Muchakunda, shown mercy by Lord Shri Krishna, offered obeisances and circumambulated him. The king then left the cave and saw that humans, animals, trees, and plants were all smaller than when he had fallen asleep. Be pretty strange, huh? Fall asleep and you wake up and everything shrunk. From this he could understand that the age of Kali was at hand. Thus, in the mood of detachment from all material association, the king began worshipping the Supreme Lord Sri Hari. Sri Krishna returned to Mathura, which was still under siege by the barbarian army. He destroyed this army, collected all the valuables the soldiers had been carrying, and set off for Dwarka. Just then, Jarasandha arrived on the scene with a force of 23 Akshohinis. Lord Balaram and Lord Krishna, acting as if fearful, left their riches aside and ran far away. Because Jarasandha could not appreciate their true power, he ran after them. After running a long way, Rama and Krishna came to a mountain named Pravarshana and proceeded to climb it. Jarasandha thought they had hidden inside a cave and looked all over for them. Unable to find them, he built fires on all sides of the mountain. Be pretty scary, huh? Go up a mountain and there's fires on all sides of the mountain. But not for Krishna. As the vegetation on the mountain slopes burst into flame, Krishna and Balaram jumped off the peak. After reaching the ground unseen by Jarasandha and his followers, they returned to the Dwarka fort, which floated within the sea. Jarasandha decided that Rama and Krishna had burned to death in the fire, and he took his army back to his kingdom. At this point, Maharaj Prakrit asked a question, and Sri Sukadeva Goswami responded to it by beginning to narrate the history of the marriage of Lord Sri Krishna and Rukmini. Rukmini, the young daughter of Bhishmaka, king of Vidarbha, had heard of Sri Krishna's beauty, strength, and other fine qualities, and she therefore made up her mind that he would be the perfect husband for her. Traditionally, in the West, the man proposes to the woman, but in this case, the woman proposed to the man. Now, they're starting to talk now in the West, you know, is it okay for the woman to propose? It doesn't really happen very often. But here we see 5,000 years ago, the woman proposed. Lord Krishna also wanted to marry her, but although Rukmini's other relatives approved of her marriage to Krishna, her brother Rukmi was envious of the Lord and thus forbade her to marry him. Rukmi wanted her to marry Shishupal instead. Such drama, huh? A has drama and adventure and scary situations and faking your death and nice cool things. This is very typical in romance stories. Right? The boy and girl would have some obstacle. So even Krishna, does Krishna need to have any obstacles? He's God. He could just arrange everything so that there were no obstacles.
Just imagine the contrast between Shishupal and Krishna.
Whoa.
Pretty scary for one.
Whoa, you know, you're this young girl and you have a choice between Shishupal and Krishna. Wow. Thank you. Thank you, Ed. Never quite thought of it like that before. That's lovely. Thank you very much. Right. Rukmi wanted her to marry Shishupal instead. Rukmini unhappily took up her duties in preparation for the marriage. But she also sent a trustworthy brahmana to Krishna with a letter. There's just such drama in this, you know. So she's externally getting ready, unhappily, and she's secretly sends a letter with a brahmana. By the way, do you know who that brahmana was in his past life? Okay, a little hint. He helped Sita and Ram get married. Well, who was the brahmana who brought Ram and Lakshman to Mithila to engage in the contest to marry Sita? Yes, Vishwamitra. And guess what he does in Chaitanya Leela? He arranges the marriage of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Lakshmi. So what rasa would that be? Parental. Parental ras. Do you see there's so many varieties? It's not just all the people in parental rasa are like Mother Yasoda and Nandamars. So Vishwamitra Muni, he wanted to become a brahmana out of envy initially of Vasistha. But when you become a real brahmana, you don't have much envy anymore. Even if envy motivated you to become a brahmana, if you actually become a brahmana, if you become a real brahmana, your envy will, not completely, it's not transcendental, but your envy will dissipate. So he became a real brahmana. And then he became a real devotee. Actually became a devotee, entered into the Leela, and became the matchmaker for Ram and Sita. And here again, he's the matchmaker for Rukmini and Krishna, and then he's the matchmaker for Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Lakshmi. Wouldn't that be nice? To be the matchmaker for the Lord and his consort? So Brahmana gets this secret letter, and he's going, you know, to Dwarka and delivering the letter and writing back the speed of the wind with Krishna, giving the message. Hey, all this secrecy, too, you know. Secrecy. Is it going to work out? Is it going to work out? Who's Rukmini going to marry? When the Brahmin arrived in Dwarka, Sri Krishna properly honored him with ritual worship and other tokens of reverence. The Lord then asked the Brahmana why he had come. Isn't that funny? The whole thing is so funny. You know, our idea of Leela and our idea of God is just so wonderful. And most of the world has this idea of God is so boring. You ever seen those Christian tracts, you know, the faceless God in the suit on the throne?
God seems almost scary.
Almost. Faceless God in the suit on the throne, and the people are ant-like, you know, and there's this big screen, like we have this board here, big screen where you see everything in your life, and there's all these witnesses too, you know. My God, that's pretty scary. Anybody here want every detail of their life put on a big screen right now?
Sounds more like
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then there's these little ant-like people, and God looks at the screen and he goes, Heaven! Hell! And that's all he does. That's all he does, you know. And then there's some angels in the clouds going, Gloria, Gloria. And he just knows everything. And everything just happens exactly the way he wants. There's no drama. But that's not our understanding of Krishna. So there's drama. Oh no! The girl I marry is going to be married to Shishupal. The girl I want to marry, the girl I'm in love with, she's going to be married to Shishupal. Will we get there on time? And then Brahman comes, oh, excuse me, why have you come? What are you doing here? The Brahmana opened Rukmini's letter and showed it to Lord Krishna, who had the messenger read it to him. Rukmini Devi wrote, ever since I have heard about you, my lord, I have become completely attracted to you. Without fail, please come before my marriage to Shishupal and take me away. This is a good prayer. I think we should all pray like this. My dear Kalachanji, I've been having this long-term affair with Maya Devi. Before the contract is sealed, would you please come and take me away? I think we should all say this prayer to Kalachanji. Yeah? In accordance with that, not only did she ask him to take her away, she didn't just say, please take me away and I'm sure you'll figure out how to do it. She proposed a plan. So this is very instructive for all of us in our service. That we can come to Krishna with a proposal for service. So sometimes we think that it all has to be just orders, but we can also have a proposal. We'll talk about this in a few minutes. I don't want to talk about too much now. Anyway, she came up with a proposal. In accordance with family custom, on the day before my marriage, I will visit the temple of Goddess Ambika. That would be the best opportunity for you to appear and easily kidnap me. If you do not show me this favor, I will give up my life by fasting and observing severe vows. Then perhaps in my next life, I will be able to obtain you. Such determination she had. After reading Rukmini's letter to Lord Krishna, the Brahmana took his leave so he might carry out his daily religious duties. That's also kind of interesting. There, we see that those who worship Krishna in Mathura and Dwarka, some of them are Raga Bhaktas, some of them are Vaidhi Bhaktas, and some are some combination. In Vaikuntha, everybody's Vaidhi. So here in Dwarka, this Brahmana, he's there right with Krishna. Oh, I've got to perform my religious rituals. That's Vaidhi Bhakti. So there may be some mix, I don't know, in this person. It's not just Raghunuga. The cowherd boys, they don't say to Krishna, my dear Krishna, I have to go now and perform my religious rituals. They just say, hey, Krishna, taste this samosa. Here you go. And they may even bite it first. Oh, that was really good. Hey, check it out. And they even open up the samosa and take out the veggies and put in jasmine flowers. Hey, Krishna, check this out. And they throw it to him, you know, and everybody laughs. So this Brahmana would never have done something like that. He says, now, my lord, now that I've given you my message, I have to perform my regulated religious functions. Excuse me, while I go worship you in my regulated religious functions. Okay, I'm going to read text 1 and text 2. Text 1. Jisuka uvacha itam sonu grahito naga. I'm not getting this right. Itam son grahitonga. Itam sonu grahitonga. There we go. Sorry about that. Krishne Kshvaku Nandana. Tam parikramya sanyamya. Nishchakrama guha mukat. Please check.
Trisuka uvacha, itamsonugrahitonga, 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 Krishne nikshvaku nandana, Krishne nikshvaku nandana, tam parikramya sanamya, tam parikramya sanamya, nishchakrama. Krishna 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 Krishna
Ladies? Shukadev Goswami said, Itam, in this manner, Saha, he, Anugrahita, shown mercy, Anga, my dear Parikit Maharaj, Krishnena, my Lord Krishna, Ishvaku Nandana, Muchakunda, the beloved descendant of Ishvaku. Tam, him. Parikramya, circumambulating. Sanyamya, bowing down. Nishchakrama, he went out. Guha, of the cave. Mukhat, from the mouth. Translation. Sukadeva Goswami said, my dear king, thus graced by Lord Krishna, Muchakunda circumambulated him and bowed down to him. Then Muchakunda, the beloved descendant of Ishvaku, exited through the mouth of the cave. I'm going to read text 2. Translation. Seeing that the size of all the human beings, animals, trees, and plants was severely reduced, and thus realizing that the age of Kali was at hand, Muchakunda left for the north. Purport. There are several significant words in this verse. A standard Sanskrit dictionary gives the following English meaning for the word kshulaka: little, small, low, vile, poor, indigent, wicked, malicious, abandoned, hard, pained, distressed. These are the symptoms of the age of Kali, and all these qualities are said here to apply to men, animals, plants, and trees in this age. We who are enamored of ourselves and our environment can perhaps imagine the superior beauty and living conditions available to people in former ages. The last line of this text, Jagama Dishan Uttaran, he went towards the north, can be understood as follows. By traveling north in India, one comes to the world's highest mountains, the Himalayan range. There one can still find many beautiful peaks and valleys where there are quiet hermitages suitable for austerity and meditation. Thus, in Vedic culture, quote, going to the north, unquote, indicates renouncing the comforts of ordinary society and going to the Himalayan mountains to practice serious austerities for spiritual advancement. So I'm going to read this section also from Krishna book. Prabhupada says, when Muchakunda, the celebrated descendant of the Ishvaku dynasty, was favored by Lord Krishna, he circumambulated the Lord within the cave and then came out. On coming out of the cave, Muchakunda saw that the stature of the human species has surprisingly been reduced to pygmy size. That means we're all pygmy size. Similarly, the trees had also far reduced in size, and Muchakunda could immediately understand that the current age was Kali Yuga. Therefore, without diverting his attention, he began to travel north. So Muchakunda was given an instruction by Krishna that Krishna said to him, in your life as a kshatriya, you perform yajnas with animals. You have to do penance for this. So please go and perform penance and austerity, and your next life you'll attain perfection. Now, that's kind of interesting. You think, why didn't he attain perfection in that life? And the acharyas comment that his next life simply meant his next existence in the spiritual world. Didn't mean another life in the material world. And they explained that the reason that Krishna told Muchakunda to perform austerities is he didn't belong in Kali Yuga. He was a giant. and he couldn't really enter Krishna's pastimes in that body. It just wouldn't have been appropriate. He was from another age. And therefore, Krishna kind of had to get him out of the way. So he said, just go perform austerity somewhere, you know, to the end of this life. And gave some excuse, well, you have to perform austerity. He didn't have any sinful activity, any sinful reactions left after having seen Krishna. But Krishna instructed him like that for the sake of his pastimes. And so therefore, when Muchakunta came out of the cave, he saw, okay, because Krishna wasn't that specific, he should just do austerities and penances, giving a sort of general instruction. And then Muchakunta looks around and he saw himself, I don't belong here. Immediately he could understand, I don't have any business here. I'm not from this atmosphere, I'm from a different atmosphere, I belong to a different place. And so he didn't do penances and austerities among the general population, but he went far away from everybody to the Himalayas. And it's interesting, this idea of going to the north is associated with austerity. Going south is associated with death. So there's, even we have an association of north with up and south with down. And we have an association of up with good and down with bad. It's sort of interesting. Even in the whole universe, in the fifth canto, it's explained there's kind of a north and a south. So here we see Muchakunda is understanding what he should do according to his service to the Lord. He's in the mood of a servant. So Lord Krishna says, perform austerities. He's going to perform austerities. He was a fighter. He fought on behalf of the demigods. There's still a lot of demons on the planet. He could have gone out and fought with the demons. Because right after this, we see Jarasandha still active. Muchakunda could have said, you know, well, wow, look at Kali Yuga. There's so many problems in Kali Yuga. I'm the perfect person to deal with it. I was fighting the demons on the upper planets. Let me go and fight all the demons here. But he had the order of the Lord on his head. So even though he was capable to fight with the demons, and even though he certainly, we would imagine, felt some sorrow at seeing how bad the situation was. It's like sometimes we stay in a temple for a while, and then we come back and visit years later, and it's all dilapidated. We had the experience in New York that we were there when ISKCON devotees bought the huge temple on 55th Street. So I don't know if any of you ever saw that building. You saw the building. So it was 11 stories plus a downstairs. And the downstairs had a restaurant. I think we could fit about 200 people in the restaurant. And then we had a humongous kitchen. The kitchen was practically as big as this temple room. Then we had a separate bakery. We used to get between 75 and 150 people in that restaurant every day. Then we had our gift shop was a storefront. It was right on the street. We were right in Midtown Manhattan. I mean, the only other place I know that has that kind of location is the Soho Street Temple. But the Soho Street Temple in London, the shop is upstairs. Whereas in our Manhattan building, the shop was downstairs on street level, so you could walk in from the street directly into the shop. And we had an honor membership program, so that if you pay $333 and vowed to chant one round a day, you became an honor member. We made an average of 3 honor members a day, primarily through the shop. Then we had a huge temple room. I mean, it was at least 3 times the size of this temple. At least. Sure. You know, we had a full reception area, elevators. We had a professional theater. We had 2 huge, huge, huge prasadam rooms. We had all facility for the press. We had 2 floors for the brahmacharis, 1 for the brahmacharinis, 1 for the householders without children, 1 for the householders with children, 1 for the guests, 1 for the VIP guests.
That was in London.
No, this is in Manhattan.
No, that's New York. Manhattan,
New York City. And then a rooftop garden. And Srila Prabhupada came to that temple. He stayed there. He was there for the 76 Rath Yatra, and he was so happy that we had this magnificent building, you know, right in the center of Manhattan. As I said, the only place we have today that's equivalent to this in terms of location is our building in London, but that's a very, very small building. It's a very small building, and the storefront is not... The restaurant is right on the street, whereas on Manhattan property, you had the restaurant, you had to go into the building and downstairs. So in the London property, the restaurant's right on the street, but the shop's upstairs. But the building's very, very small. It's very cramped. The temple room there is maybe half... This room, very small. I mean, festivals are almost impossible there. And even living there is very difficult. Even walking up and down the stairs, the stairs are very narrow. They hardly accommodate two people at a time. So it's a very tiny building, whereas the Manhattan building, we could fit about 300 devotees in there. And quite literally, every Mangalartik, there were 300 people at Mangalartik.
It's so impressive to have Hare Krishna right down the side
of the building.
Yes.
And I mean, if you wanted to distribute books, you just walked out the door. It was amazing. And then through the, we have to say, you know, foolishness of the person in charge, the building was sold. And we have not had a situation in New York anywhere close since then. Not anywhere close at all. So we used to still go to New York for Rath Yatra, but for 5 years, our family never wanted to visit the temple because it was so depressing, you know, to have had this incredible, incredible facility. And then to have lost it, we couldn't bear to see the you know the new facility. So I imagine the King Mukunda felt something like this. That he knew what the earth was like in its glorious past, and now he was seeing. And look, this is 5,000 years ago when Krishna was on the planet. What to speak of what it's like now? So I'm sure it affected him, but he didn't take any action. He didn't do anything to fix anything. He just went to the north to perform austerities because that was his service. One time when I was in Vrindavan, I was complaining to Burajan Prabhu, my godbrother Burajan Prabhu, about something with the management there many years ago. And he said, "Urmila, is this your service?" And I said, "Well, not really." He said, "Then why are you dealing with it?" I said, "It just bothers me so much." And he said, "Well, then you have to just tell the authorities." I said, "I did. They don't do anything about it." He said, "Then you can tell the next higher authorities." I said, "I did. They didn't do anything about it." "Well, then you can tell the next higher authorities." I said, "I did. They didn't do anything about it." And he said, "Well, then go talk to Balaram." I said, "Why Balaram?" He said, "Well, it's not Radhasham's temple." He said, "Everybody thinks it's Radhasham's temple, but it's really Krishna Balaram's temple." I said, "Oh, yeah, that's true." I said, "Well, why Balaram?" He said, "Well, he's the older brother." So I went to Balaram and I said, "Balaram, here's the problem. Please take care of it." And then I didn't do anything more, and a year later it got fixed. So we are servants. Jivara Swarupaya Krishnara Nityadasha. We are servants. That our Sanatan Dharma is to serve. So we can think of serving as meaning giving, that we have a nature of being givers rather than takers. And all of our suffering comes from trying to be takers instead of givers. 100% of our suffering comes from trying to be takers instead of givers. But it's not only that we're givers. When we say our Sanatana Dharma is to be a servant, it's not only just that we're givers in general, but we're supposed to give to a specific person, namely Krishna, and we're supposed to give to that specific person something that he likes. And Rupa Goswami defines bhakti, anyabhilasita sunyam gyanakama anavratam anukulena krishna nushilanam bhakti uttama. Activities to please Krishna. Not just activities, but activities that please Krishna. Therefore, Kamsa is not counted as doing bhakti because he wasn't trying to please Krishna. So all of us have this question, you know, what am I supposed to do? We ask this question on a moment-by-moment basis and on a daily basis and a weekly basis and a monthly basis. What am I supposed to do? What can I do that will bring me the most happiness and peace and satisfaction? This is our question. Mukunda comes out of the cave, he's woken up, what do I do? His day's begun, what do I do today? What am I supposed to do? So I think all of us have already figured out that what we're supposed to do is serve Krishna. I think we've already got that. And we discussed a couple days ago the difference between materialistic life and spiritual life. So I think we've gotten, at least theoretically, the concept that I'm not supposed to serve illusion by pretending to be a taker and being in association with other takers and seeing who can take the most. I pretend to give to you and you pretend to give to me, but I'm really trying to take from you and you're really trying to take from me. We've sort of kind of figured out that that's not what we're supposed to be doing. That doesn't bring us any happiness. okay, I'm supposed to serve Krishna. And then the question comes up, how do I serve Krishna? What service should I do? When I first read the Bhagavad Gita when I was in college, and it kept talking about prescribed duties, I couldn't understand that phrase. It didn't make sense to me as an American in the 1970s. Prescribed duties. Duties? What are my duties? Prescribed? Where are they scribed? Where are they written? Written by who? And I get this question wherever I go. What are my duties? Am I supposed to be renunciated? Am I supposed to get married? Am I supposed to have children or not? Am I supposed to work or not? What kind of job am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to do some service in the temple? What service am I supposed to do? Or, as we're seeing here, there's some problems. I see things have fallen apart. Am I supposed to fix it, or am I not supposed to fix it? Do I get involved? Do I not get involved? How do I get involved? What do I do to get involved? Was Mucchakunda competent to fix a lot of these problems? For sure. He was competent to fix problems in another age for the demigods. So how do we know what to do? You know, general, I'm a servant of Krishna, but what is my service? What service do I do? What service that I do that will please Krishna? You know, we talk a lot about you should please Krishna. How do you please Krishna? Then you could say, well, you can ask the guru. Well, maybe your guru's given a general instruction. Or, you know, it's interesting. I know of one devotee where Srila Prabhupada gave this devotee an instruction, you know, like 1971 or something. And that devotee has taken that instruction is kind of a lifetime instruction. And so they've done that their whole life. And I know another devotee the Prabhupada gave an instruction to, and that devotee took it as a temporary instruction. Although there was no particular indication in either case as to whether it was a temporary or a lifetime instruction. I mean, I know one devotee Prabhupada said, you should preach here. But that devotee doesn't preach there anymore. They preach someplace else. So I said, well, why didn't you stay there and preach? And the devotee said, well, I understood that as a time, place, and circumstance instruction. And the other devotee said, well, I understood this as a lifetime instruction. So interesting. So your guru may have given you a very specific instruction. I mean, the only specific instruction Srila Prabhupada gave me was very circumstantial. You know, or the guru may have given just general instructions. Or the guru may have given instructions that apply in a certain area of your life and they don't anymore. Maybe your guru's not physically available anymore. How does one know what to do? Of course, one can say, well, one can go to Shiksha Gurus. Right? So what are the principles? Why do we even have to have a prescribed duty altogether? Why can't we just say, well, okay, there's so many things that will please Krishna, I'll just pick one. Or two, or three, I'll just do this. So we're empowered in certain areas of service. When we're in our proper place, we're then empowered. Just like Arjuna. So I was just reading the part of the Bhagavatam where Arjuna is lamenting the passing of Krishna. And he talks about how he was empowered in the battle of Kurukshetra to fight the war, but after Krishna left, he wasn't empowered like that anymore. The Prabhupada specifically says in a purport that he didn't need that empowerment to go back to Godhead, therefore it was removed. So Krishna empowers us for the job at hand. That's interesting. It reminds me of a story, very famous story, of two sisters and their father who helped people during the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands. So they were arranging for phony food ration cards, and they were sheltering people and moving them from one place to another. And this one woman particularly, Corrie ten Boom, she saved hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. And then they were all captured, the father and the two sisters, and put into the concentration camps, and only Corrie survived. When she came out of the camps, the war was still going on. And she thought, well, let me just pick up my activities. And she went back to the office and got back in touch with the underground and tried to do the work again, and she couldn't do it. She didn't have the empowerment was gone. And she realized, oh, you know, I'm not supposed to be doing that anymore. I'm supposed to be doing something else. I don't have the shakti to do this. When Bhima was fighting with Jarasandha under the instructions of Krishna, and Krishna is standing right there. After fighting for a month, he still hadn't defeated Jarasandha, and he said, Nashaktoham Jarasandha, Nirjaitam Yudhimadava. Nashaktoham Jarasandha. I don't have the Shakti. And then Krishna, Pyayam Swayam Tejasa. Krishna empowered Bhima with his own energy and gave him a little hint with the grass splitting in two. So if we want to be empowered, we have to be in our area of service. If we're in at someone else's area of service, we don't have the empowerment anymore. It's like we don't have the sanction. I have a friend who used to manage a whole company, and now is just managing a very small part of another company. And he's such a competent person that he's capable of managing the whole company. So he finishes his work, kind of like Bhaktivinoda Thakur finished, 8 hours of work in 2 hours. So my friend's like that. He can finish 8 hours of work in 2 hours. So he finishes all of his work, and then he has nothing to do. So he started getting involved in other areas of the company that weren't his job and fixing all kinds of things. And then he told me, but then the president came up to me and said, we really don't want you to do this. Even though what you're doing is good for the company, it's not your job. So please stop. I said, what do you do now? He said, well, I'm bored half the day. Unfortunately, that's a material master. But the point is that we're empowered in a certain area. So we want to find our particular area of empowerment, and that may change, just like in Arjuna's life it changed. He was empowered in one way one time of his life, another way another time of his life, for him, which Kundals. He had an empowerment at one time of his life and not an empowerment at another time of his life. So for some people, they may have some service they're given their whole life, and they're empowered in that their whole life. And for other people, it may change over the course of their life. Another reason we should find our service is that Krishna says, even if you meet destruction in your own duty, that's better than to be so-called successful in someone else's duty. The success of our service is whether or not Krishna is pleased. The success of our service is not the external result. Just like Krishna told the cowherd boys, go beg for the brahmanas. And the brahmanas didn't even answer them. They came back empty-handed. In Ananda Vrindavan Champu, the cowherd boys say, how has nectar become salty? How has your infallible order failed? Srila Prabhupada tried to preach in English in India before coming to America, and he was largely a failure. He said he would go to families and say, you have 4 or 5 sons, give me one of them, I'll train him as a devotee, as a brahmana, and they'd say, what use is that? Prabhupada started a center in Jhansi, made one disciple, had some small interest, and then the governor's wife said, oh, we want this to give vocational training to ladies, we're taking it away. Prabhupada went to the Gaudiya Math temple in Delhi and said, I've arranged to print double the number of magazines for the same price. They said, we don't want to print double the number of magazines. Then we'll have to figure out how to sell them. Why don't you go to Vrindavan? There's a parikram there. And I probably tried several times. It was a failure. Wasn't really able to make any headway at all. But it was the order of his spiritual master, or the brahmana, who was told by his guru to read the Bhagavad Gita, but he couldn't read it very well. So he's, struggling to try to read it, but he's crying, thinking about Krishna. So externally, he was a failure. He wasn't able to read the Bhagavad Gita. You wouldn't employ him on Gita Jayanti to read the Bhagavad Gita. So another reason to do our service is even so-called failure in our service is glorious. Prabhupada's failure in India glorified his Western disciples. Didn't it? Just like the cowherd boy's failure with the brahmanas glorified the wives. If the cowherd boys had gone directly to the wives, they wouldn't be so glorified. But in contrast to the husbands, they're glorified. The culture that wasn't taken up by the traditional persons of India in the 40s, 50s, 60s was taken up by the counterculture hippies, because they didn't call themselves hippies. That was a term applied by others. Anyway, the members of the counterculture in America. People that the conservative, traditional followers of the Vedic system would have looked down on, not just as untouchable mleches, but as untouchable untouchables. the untouchables of the, and they took it up. You know, Jatayu's failure in stopping Ravana was his success. So we don't measure where we belong by whether or not externally we're successful. We measure where we belong by where we're empowered and by where we'll please Krishna. Whether externally it's a failure or a success. And we can be peaceful not getting in anybody else's service because we know that Krishna is a very expert boss. First of all, he's not like my friend's boss who has the person be bored half the day. Krishna knows how to engage us nicely in a way that we'll be satisfied. Krishna knows much better than we do what kind of service and what situation will satisfy us. Krishna also is taking care of everything else, whether we see it or not, and whether it happens according to our time schedule or not. We may see, oh, there's this big problem over here that I could fix even though it's not my service. But Krishna has his way of taking care of it, and he has his own time frame. Like the demigods complained about the demons on the earth, and Krishna said, yes, I'll come. He said, first, the elders have to come. So, you know, first Vasudeva and Devaki, Nanda and Yasoda took birth, and they had to grow up, and they had to get married. That's at least, what, 20 years or so, and Vasudeva had other wives, he was probably at least 30. That's at least 30 years between the time that Bhumi went with her appeal, and Vasudeva and Devaki got married, then there's the voice in the sky, and then Krishna's not the first child, he's the eighth child, so that's another 8 years, so that's at least 38 years. And then he doesn't immediately come, so he goes to Vrindavan. Then he comes back after, let's say, 11, it can be 11 or 16 years. So then we have 49 years later, after Bhumi makes her appeal, Kamsa's killed. So Krishna has his own time frame, he has his own way of handling things. And his way of handling things is best. Yesterday I was talking to the temple president, Nityananda Prabhu, and he was telling me how that there was all these false rumors spread about him, and so he was thrown out of the temple for a few years. And when he was thrown out of the temple, Krishna arranged that he got exactly the kind of experience that would suit him to come back and be the temple president. He got exactly the kind of experience and knowledge that he needed to come back and do his service. So at the time, I'm sure it seemed pretty horrible. People are spreading lies about you, and you can't come to the temple. But it was Krishna facilitating him. And I had a similar experience. I was working on a book project, and my daughter-in-law broke her foot, and I put aside my project and went to help her. And while I was helping her, I thought, what am I doing here? I'm just attached to my family. I should be working on my book. But what I learned in that month with my daughter-in-law helped me so much that when I came back to my book, the work went 10 times faster. And I saw it wasn't a diversion. Krishna said, oh, this is what your service is? Okay, I'm going to speed it up for you. I'm going to make it easier for you. Hey, go over here for a while. This is something you have to learn. So when we're properly situated in our service, Krishna's taking care of everything that everyone else is supposed to do, and Krishna's making all the arrangements for what we're supposed to do. You know, we may not see that because we're very small and very foolish. But Krishna is setting up everything properly. So that's our perfection, is to be in our area of service. You know, Muchikunda didn't complain and say, well, wait a minute, why can't I just enter into your lila now? Why do I have to go do penances? But he accepted, this is what Krishna wants me to do. This is what will be perfect for me. This is what will be perfect for Krishna. This will be perfect for the world. Krishna has his own plan to take care of the problems of Kali Yuga that's not my business. You think about, you know, a soldier in the military. They do their job and they trust that the generals have some plan. So we have the best general. So how do we figure out what our service is? First, we have to accept the concept that we're servants and not masters. That we're givers and not takers. We first have to get that. That's a really hard thing for conditioned souls to get. Frankly, even after coming to the Krishna Consciousness Movement and chanting Hare Krishna and taking prasadam, we may still really struggle with this idea. And not even know we're struggling with it. So givers, and givers to whom? Giver to Krishna, giver to Guru. Giver how? Giver in the way that's going to please Krishna. And that's not going to be the same for each of us. just isn't. It's not going to be the same for each of us. I mean, some things are going to be the same. She has 16 rounds, follow the four principles. But a lot of the details of what we do are going to be different. And they're going to maybe be different for us at different times of our life. Like Prabhupada told one devotee, you're eating too much prasadam. And the devotee said, but Prabhupada, you told me to eat a lot of prasadam. Prabhupada said, did you believe me then? Oh, believe me now. So when somebody's 20 years old, we may say, hey, you need to get married. And when they're 50 years old, we may say, you need to get unmarried. Same person, different times in the life, different instruction. Right? So then how do we know what's right for me and what's right for me now? What's the proper service for me and what's the proper service for me now? So the easiest thing, of course, is to ask our guru. That's our Diksha Guru, Shiksha Guru. And all of us should have somebody in our lives with whom we can consult. Even if our Diksha Guru is no longer physically present or it's some situation where our Diksha Guru is not in a position to advise us for whatever reason. Now, even if we don't have some sort of official Shiksha Guru, we should have somebody that we can go to, somebody who knows us, somebody who cares about us, and somebody that we trust, that we can say what's proper for me and what's proper for me now. Which may be the opposite of what was proper for me a year ago or a month ago. And to make sure that person really has our interests in mind. Not just somebody who has, you know, some job to get done and they want, you know, human cannon fodder and we happen to be available. Someone who's not just thinking of the external need, but who's thinking about us. So Krishna was also here thinking about Muchikunda. It would be very awkward for him. He didn't belong. It wasn't where he belonged. It would be awkward for the other participants in the Leela, and it would be awkward for him. I mean, a few years ago, I was asked to do some service. And I was pretty excited about it. It was something that I thought, okay, I can really make a difference to the movement by doing this service. And very quickly, I saw I didn't belong there. That my mentality and my personality was not the same as the other devotees that were working there. I don't want to be too specific. But I can understand I don't belong here. I felt like I had been parachuted in the middle of into a pro football game, American pro football game, and I was looking up at all these 300-pound people ready to tackle me. So, you know, then I consulted with some people. They said, yeah, you shouldn't be there. It's not the right place for you. So here it was the opposite. Muchikunda would have been the pro football player and everybody else would have been the little pygmies. You know? So, you know, it's not the proper place. You're not going to be comfortable there. It's not going to be your environment. So the best thing is, of course, we ask authorities. Then we should also have some introspection, look at our own nature. Like in this circumstance, I looked at my own nature. I consulted with authorities and also looked at my own nature. So this doesn't fit. It's not who I am. And more I've been able to do that. People ask, okay, can you do this or do that? And I can think, you know, wait a minute. Does that fit with who I am or not? So we should also have to get some maturity and introspection and devotional service. Maybe you can't do that the first year, but at some point one should get some sense. Who am I? What's the environment in which I function the best? What's the kind of circumstances in which I function the best? Do I function the best if I have some authority? Do I function the best if I'm just told what to do? Do I function the best if I'm a member of a team? Do I function the best if I'm just told step by step, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this? Do I function the best if I'm just told, hey, get this result and you figure out how to do it? Do I function the best working with a lot of people? Do I function the best working on my own, just doing a task? Do I function the best doing things that are repetitive? Do I function the best doing something different all the time? Do I function the best where there's a lot of security, or do I function the best where there's a lot of freedom? And these are things we should know about ourselves. That's not our eternal personality, but we should know what our nature is in this life. And be able to discuss with our authorities, and be able to discuss with the other devotees, you know, this will really work for me, or this really won't work for me. And here we go back to Rukmini. And I said I was going to come back to Rukmini. So it's not just orders. Rukmini wasn't being given an order by anybody, was she? Anybody order Rukmini? Your services to Mary Krishna? Did anybody give her that order? No. She took it into her own hands. She made a request. She made a request. So there's orders and there are requests. Is there anything wrong with making a request? Is Rukmini faulted for making a request? Sometimes we think it's more surrendered to be ordered, but it's not a fact. Either is acceptable. The request can be denied. We don't make a demand. We don't say, Kala Chanji, I want to do this. I'm just going to do it, whether you like it or not. I talked to one lady some time ago, and she's going on a vacation to visit some of her family and taking the baby and leaving the rest of the children at home with her husband. And I said, oh, how did he agree to that? She said he didn't. I just told him I was doing it and he could like it or not. I'm buying the ticket and I'm going to see my relatives and taking the baby and you watch the older children, bye. So you shouldn't do that with Krishna. Whether you should do that with your husband or not is another discussion, but certainly, oh, there's somebody back there. So we shouldn't do that with Krishna. Krishna, I'm gonna do this service for you and I don't care whether you like it or not. That's not bhakti. Just like if someone's trying to serve us. Someone's trying to do something for us. So, do we mind if people offer to do some specific service? Does that really bother us? Do we feel we have to order everybody? Do we want a situation where we have to order everybody who does things for us? No. We sometimes may ask, and we sometimes will be asked. Sometimes we may ask, hey, you know, I don't have a car. I had to ask one of my friends here, I don't have a car. I need to go get something. Can you drive me? Sometimes I may ask. And sometimes somebody may ask me, hey, would you like me to do this for you? And then I can say yes or no. If we try to force and demand on Krishna, that's not service. Nor do we have to always passively wait for an order. So I think of it like a dance. You know, a dance is two people. It's not that one person is just there kind of like a wooden, you know, piece of wood, and the other dancer is sort of pushing them around the way they want. But Prabhupada says early in Krishna book that the whole world is full of Krishna singing. He said, and Krishna's dancing, so we should dance with Krishna, not independently or with somebody else. So dancing with Krishna, means that there's a give and take. So sometimes Krishna and Guru may give a very specific order, hey, go fight the Kurus, do it. And sometimes we may make a request, Krishna, would you kidnap me, please? And not only did she make a request, she even suggested how and when he could do it. Would you kidnap me, please? And would you please kidnap me? Hey, this would be a good time if you want to do it. I've kind of already worked it out, if you like my plan. So we can present a plan to Krishna. I have one friend who was doing a lot of preaching to new people, but he wasn't at all satisfied with the program that he was working with. So he had an idea of how it could be improved, and he was a pujari, worshipping Chaitanya Mahaprabhu on the temple altar. So he wrote up his plan. He wrote down his plan, and presented it to the deity in the evening when he was dressing. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And a couple weeks later, somebody came to the temple property, and that was his job, was to show guests around. So he was showing this guest around. And this particular guest ended up developing a relationship where he took this devotee as sort of a mentor. And after about a month, the gentleman said to the devotee, I'd like to give you a donation for all the help that you've done for me. What should I give? And the devotee said, you know, well, you can give in their currency. He said, you can give, you know, one or a million, whatever you want. You think about it. So about a week later, the man calls him up and said, I thought about it, I'm going to give you a million. And then his whole project was funded. So he understood, you know, that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had approved of his plan. So we can present like that. We can say to Krishna, Krishna, I'd like to serve you like this. And we can even present to Krishna a plan. He may approve of the service, but not the plan. That certainly happened to me. Krishna approves of one service that I presented, but he had a whole different plan. completely different. That was much better than my plan. That was very interesting. Or Krishna may approve of the service and the plan, or he may not approve of either. He may say, no, I want you to do something else. Or it may just be an order. Go and do this. And we should be satisfied with whatever service we're doing for Krishna. Srila Prabhupada wrote a letter to Jayaprataka Swami. He said, one should think, whatever is meant to be, that I am doing. So it sounds kind of new agey. You are where you're meant to be. But that's what Srila Prabhupada said. Whatever is meant to be, that I am doing. So if we're chanting our 16 rounds, three Gayatris, following the regulative principles, worshipping the deity, eating prasadam, then we should understand that Krishna is controlling our life. We're not orphans anymore. So if we're within that circle of following, then whatever is meant to be, that I am doing. Even if you get kicked out of the temple and people tell lies about you, Prabhupada was kicked out of the Delhi temple by the Gaudiya Math. Spent 4 years wandering homelessly, counting his paisa to take the trains. And then another 4 or 5 years in Radha Damodar writing his books. Whatever is meant to be, that I am doing. And Prabhupada said, we should give full attention to every detail of our service, to do it expertly. For Krishna's only pleasure is our motive, he says, no matter what it is. So if my service right now is cleaning the toilet, if my service right now is distributing a book, if my service right now is cooking the pakoras, if my service right now is changing my baby's diaper, if my service, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. If this is what Krishna has given to me, and whatever is meant to be, that I am doing, and I trust that Krishna is working in my life for my good and for the good of others. Krishna is time, kalosmi. My time belongs to Krishna. And he can say, you know, I may think, I have this important thing to do, and 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 Krishna says, hey, I want you to spend an hour helping this person right now. Yes, Krishna. My time belongs to you. I mean, any of us who are initiated, we have given Krishna our time. I mean, it was always his, really. Well, wasn't it? We've acknowledged that my time belongs to Krishna, my energy belongs to Krishna. And if Krishna appeared right in front of us and said, okay, this is what I want you to do, this is what I want you to do, could we argue? So as Krishna unfolds, as Krishna Guru and the Vaishnavas unfold what we're supposed to do in our lives, we should accept joyfully. Whatever is meant to be, that I am doing. How do we know what's the most important thing to do? You know, everybody wants to do something important. Everybody wants to do something meaningful, one of the greatest human needs, to do something meaningful. But how do we know what's the most meaningful thing that we do in our lives? How do we know?
Pleasure of the spiritual master.
Yeah. I mean, I think about, like, when we go out and distribute prasadam, and somebody eats one prasadam cookie, and according to our understanding, eating that one cookie is the most significant thing they do in their whole life. Do they think that way? If you ask them, what's the most important thing you did in your life, would they say eating that cookie that the Hare Krishna gave you? Or like that Steve Jobs, when he was a poor college student, he used to eat at his local temple. And he gave, you know, a public speech where he said, the Hare Krishna saved me. They had this wonderful food every Sunday, and I would go to eat at the Hare Krishna. And there he is, publicly, in front of thousands. It got broadcast to millions and millions of people. And when Steve Jobs died, everybody was watching this video of Steve Jobs glorifying Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Now, he thought the most important thing he did in his life, he said so, was making wonderful technology available to people, improving people's lives through technology. But I would guess the most important thing he did in his life was being videoed saying, Hare Krishna is wonderful, Hare Krishna is wonderful. So do we know what's the most important thing we're doing in our life? That's my point. We don't know. We're servants. We should be satisfied being servants. We don't know. We should trust that Krishna always has me doing what's most important, what's best for me, and what's best for everybody, what's best for the movement. We should have that trust. I don't know. Maybe the person for whom I stop my duties and talk to for 2 minutes, maybe that 2-minute talk with that person is going to be the most significant thing I do in my whole life. We just don't know. Very small. And when we get this mentality, we become very satisfied. Stop trying to be the controller. Ahankaravi mudat makartahamiti manyate. I am the doer. No, Krishna's the doer. Let me cooperate with Krishna. Let me dance with Krishna. Let me do what I'm supposed to do that will please Krishna. And then we feel fully satisfied. So, questions, comments, additions, subtractions? Yes?
Sometimes your feelings are personal, and it's not necessarily that, is it working? No. It was. Okay. Anyway, sometimes we are impersonal, and sometimes we feel that the other person is very impersonal toward us, and
it's working.
Toward me.
Okay.
So the personalism in our dealings is the question, and so if we encounter that impersonalism, what is the best response?
In myself or in others? If I find that I'm being impersonal with others, or others are being impersonal with me?
I think it's more ourselves being impersonal, perceiving impersonalism in others.
So my dealing with people without empathy?
Feeling that they don't really understand me.
Okay, that they're being impersonal with me.
Vice versa.
Or that I don't really understand them. A lack of connection.
Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, it took me a little while to get that. So what happens in our dealings when we experience a lack of connection?
Thank you.
All right. So Kunti asked Krishna to sever her tie of affection for her kinsman. And Srila Prabhupada says in that purport that they're seeing in the sun and they're seeing in the darkness. And he says relationships with other jivas are perfect when it's soul to soul via the super soul. So the only way that my hand can be connected with my foot is if both my hand and my foot are connected with my body. If my hand is severed from my body, it can't really be connected with my foot anymore. Now I can take my severed hand and stick it on my foot, but my hand will not feel the connection with my foot. Although my foot would feel the connection with my hand. So if I'm severed from Krishna, I can't feel a connection with other living entities. And if I'm connected with Krishna, I can feel a connection with other living entities. And by the way, if I'm connected with Krishna, like my foot, if it's connected with my body, can feel a connection with a severed hand, but my severed hand cannot feel a connection with my connected foot. So if I'm connected with Krishna, I can feel a connection even with disconnected jivas. The other jiva does not have to be connected. I mean, we're all connected. But the other jiva doesn't have to be acting in a connected way. We can't ever be separated from Krishna. Nobody can be separated from Krishna. But another jiva can be acting in illusion, and as long as I'm connected with Krishna, I can feel the connection with that jiva. Now, if you want to know how that can work on a very practical, simple level, there's one GBC member who was giving some seminars on empathic methods of communication. And the basis of the method that he was teaching was to understand that everybody is always trying to meet their needs in all of their, everything that they're doing. Whatever actions, whatever words, whatever thoughts anybody has is an effort to meet their needs. And ultimately, the needs we're trying to meet are spiritual needs. Even if we're trying to meet our need for food and water, we're trying to meet our need basically for eternality. We want existence. Or as Srila Prabhupada also explains it, that everybody is trying to enjoy one of the 12 or some combination of the 12 rasas at every moment. That anything that motivates anybody, explains this nicely in the Nectar Devotion Preface, one of the most wonderful parts of Srila Prabhupada's books, and in Prabhupada's lectures on the preface, anything anybody does, they're trying to enjoy rasa. Prabhupada gives the example, someone commits murder, they're trying to enjoy the ghastly rasa. Prabhupada said, if you want to enjoy the ghastly rasa, actually meditate on... Who should you meditate on if you want to enjoy the ghastly rasa? The Singhadev, yes. So you meditate on the Singhadev. Or we're going to get to some pastimes of Krishna that are pretty ghastly. You know, with Jarasa, we already got to them, I guess. Jarasandha's army with the rivers of blood and the turtles' heads, so you already discussed that. So the person going out and committing murder is trying to enjoy ghastly rasa wrongly. And the person relishing the rivers of blood in the fight with Jarasandha and relishing the intestine garland on Nrisingadev is rightly relishing the ghastly rasa. Everybody's trying to get eternity, knowledge, and bliss. Everyone's trying to get bliss in all of its rasas and all of its flavors. Everyone's trying to get love. Anything that anyone does is for that purpose. Now, they may be trying to get it in the wrong place and in the wrong way, but that's what they're trying to get. And the way we can connect with anyone is go deep. Okay, what is this person really trying to get? What are they really looking for? You may not be able to get them to understand that that's what they're looking for. You may, it depends on your relationship with them. But at least you can understand. Oh, this person's... Somebody called me the other day with some marital problems, and I don't think I was able to help her. But I could understand that what she was looking for was freedom. I don't want my husband telling me what to do. If I get some money from inheritance, I want to have some right over how it's spent. I don't want to just put it in the pot and my husband decides what to do with it. I want to have some say over what I do with my free time. She's looking for freedom. Prabhupada says in first canto, the need of the soul is for freedom. She's looking for freedom. And she's not going to find it in a mundane way in her relationship with her husband, even if he let her decide how to spend half the money and even if he let her decide how to spend half of her time. She still wouldn't feel satisfied because that's not the freedom we're looking for. We're looking for the freedom from the modes of material nature, looking for freedom from lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion. So I could connect with her on that level. Whether or not she could connect with me was irrelevant. And whether or not she was able to understand my connection with her was also irrelevant. And whether or not I could help her was irrelevant. I mean, it's nice if I can help her, but irrelevant in terms of my feeling that connection. As soon as I understood, she's looking for freedom. And this freedom can only be found in Krishna. And I'm looking for freedom too. So we are one in that. She and I are one in our need for freedom. I understand that. I relate to that. I can feel that. I can feel the urge inside me to be free. I can feel the frustration and the anger and the aggravation at being in prison. I'm in the prison of my mind. I'm in the prison of my body. I'm in the prison of gravity. I'm in the prison of Kali Yuga, in the prison of living in a very polluted environment. So many prisons. And I feel that frustration. I wish I were free. So I can connect to her like that. So you can connect to any jiva. You can connect to the little bug on the flower. You can connect to the flower. You can connect soul to soul via the super soul. As George Harrison said in the beginning of Krishna book, everyone is looking for Krishna. Some don't realize that they are what they are. So with anything anybody says or does, see, how are they looking for Krishna? Remember that Krishna is Akila Rasa Rita Murti. 12 rasas. 12 rasas. So someone can be looking for Krishna in the anger rasa. Somebody can be looking for Krishna in the ghastly rasa. Somebody can be looking for Krishna in the fear rasa. Everybody's not just looking for Krishna in the comedy rasa. Does that help?
Yes.
If you practice that, it gets easier and easier and easier, by the way. I should warn you that the time when it's the most difficult to do that is if someone's acting with you in a way that's threatening to you. So if someone's treating us in a way that threatens us, that's the time that it's most difficult to connect with them. Because we start thinking about protecting myself rather than connecting with them. We go into a defense mode. So in those times, one has to first deal with one's own fears. One has to first say, Mari Rakhi Krishna, Mari Ke, Mari Krishna, Rakhi Ke. nobody can hurt me without Krishna's permission, and if Krishna wants somebody to hurt me, it must be for my good, and Krishna's taking care of me, and he's meeting all my needs, and you have to let go of the fear. And only once you let go of the fear and become a Bhayajana, not a Vindare, only then can you connect with another jiva. One cannot connect with another jiva if one is oneself disconnected from Krishna. And fear disconnects us from Krishna instantly. I mean, there's a fear, rasa, but that's different. That's Krishna's on Kali, and maybe he's going to get killed. That's a different kind of thing. But if we're afraid for our own safety and we're afraid for our own ego, especially if we're afraid for the safety of our ego, if we're afraid for the safety of our reputation, things like that, if we have that kind of fear, that immediately disconnects us from Krishna, and then we lose the capacity to connect with any other jiva. That's the source of all of our conflicts with other jivas. And as soon as I let go of the fear and I take shelter of Krishna, and again, I'm connected with Krishna and Krishna's protection, however he may want to give it, however he may want to give it, then I have the capacity to connect with the other jiva. Yes, and our time is getting quite late.
Just that, on that last point that you were making, my question is that if there is someone that's aggressive, and you say, well, if you want them to, you know, slaughter me or wipe out, you know, my family, it seems like you would take the natural response would be to take a position of wanting to protect yourself and those you love, or also being aggressive. I know there's that example of Srila Prabhupada where he criticizes so-called spirituality.
Yeah, Gandhi, yeah. Who said, if my daughter was violated in my presence, I'd remain nonviolent.
Exactly.
So it depends. When Durvasa Muni tried to kill Ambarish, Ambarish stood there with folded hands. Why? Ambarish was a king. He was being treated aggressively. He was being insulted. Why did he stand there with folded hands? Because Durvasa Muni was a? And his?
Guru.
No. Durvasa Muni was a brahmana and his?
Superior.
No. Well, superior is a brahmana, but and his? Durvasa isn't a pure.
No. I'm saying.
Yeah, but would Ambarish have done that on the battlefield? Okay. But why didn't he counter Durvasa? Durvasa was a Brahmana and his guest.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Brahmana and his guest. And Ambarish considered that he had offended his guest. Ambarish considered, I was in the wrong by drinking water. I'm sorry, I had to drink water. I didn't really have much of a good choice, but it was an offense. So Ambarish, he didn't defend himself, what to speak of counterattack. Because he's a kshatriya, he's dealing with a brahmana, and he's a householder dealing with a renunciate, and he's dealing with a guest who he offended, so he did not counterattack.
He was observing perfect etiquette.
Yes. Had he been on the battlefield, he would have counterattacked. So whether you defend depends on who you are, who the other person is. Prabhupada says superiors should never be offered even a verbal fight. Says that in the Bhagavad Gita. But if you're there, Krishna says, go kill your guru, you know, then you have to do it. But it better be Krishna telling you. So it depends. It depends. This comes right back to the main theme of this class. What's your service? What's my service? Krishna's protecting. I am not protector. Krishna's protecting me, Krishna's protecting my family, Krishna's protecting, what's my service? And what's my service now? Is my service in this circumstance to defend, or is my service in this circumstance to just stand there? What's my service? So one has to look at the whole circumstances. There's something that we should never defend under any circumstances, our pride and false ego. Well, we never, ever have a service to defend our pride and false ego. We are trying to destroy our pride and false ego. Yes? If you've walked in the door of this Hare Krishna temple, you've said, unless you just come to the restaurant, you're saying, I would please like to get rid of my false ego. It's like you go to a doctor. My dear doctor, I have a tumor. I want to get rid of it. He says, okay, here's a knife. No, don't touch it! It's crazy. Isn't that crazy? It's madness. How dare you touch my tumor? You demon doctor. But you came here and asked me to take it out. You know, imagine going to the barber. Please cut my hair. Okay. What are you doing? Get that scissors away from my head. I mean, it's madness. We should be so grateful when the other devotees attack our false ego. Thank you so much, my dear Prabhu. Never, ever, 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 ever defend our false ego and our pride. Never. Even if the other person's wrong. Even if they're wrong, don't defend our false ego and pride. Let it die. Let it be cut into pieces. It's a piece of gunk. It's a cancerous tumor. It's killing us. We should be very happy if somebody takes it apart. It's not our identity. That we should never defend. As to whether or not we should defend our body, as to whether or not we should defend our service, as to whether or not we should defend other jivas, whether we should defend possessions, whether we should defend property, whether we should defend by counterattacking, that depends. Who are you? What's the circumstance? What's going on? What's your service? There's not one answer to that. It's a principle. You do whatever is most pleasing to Krishna under that circumstance. And that's, you can't give another answer other than that. But never with the mood of defending the ego. So that defending the ego, and always with the mood of Rakhi Krishna Marike, Mari Krishna Rakhi Ke. So even if I take sword in hand and I run after the attackers and I cut off their heads, it's, you know, whether I cut off their heads or not, it's up to Krishna. When Jatayu went to fight with Ravana, it's up to Krishna. Whether I'm successful or not, whether the other person kills me, whether I kill them, whatever. You know, that's, I let go of being the doer. As Krishna says, fight for the sake of fighting without considering gain or loss, victory or defeat, honor or dishonor. I fight as a service. So if I have to defend and I have to fight, I do it as a service. Is that all right?
Yes. Excellent.
We are getting very late here. Anybody else who hasn't said anything, who has something urgent, pressing? Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Grace, Mother, and Mother, Prabhu, Ki Jai.